All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
Hey now, welcome to the Greg Fitzsimmons Show, also known as Fitz Dog. You know, the show actually used to be called the Greg Fitzsimmons Experience. And I thought it was too wordy, so I chopped it down. And I also realized that Joe had kind of simultaneously come up with the same name for his show. And Jimi Hendrix had come up with it 40 years earlier. Anyway, welcome to the Fitzdog Radio Show. It is a breezy, cool St. Patrick's Day here in Los Angeles. Why am I sober? Because I quit drinking 35 years ago. But let me tell you something. St. Patrick's Day before that was a very, very big day in my existence. It started out, I guess, when I was a kid. We would go to the St. Patrick's Day parade every year. My grandfather would march with the Ancient Order of Hibernians from the Bronx, and people were throwing up and pissing and fighting in the streets. It was crazy, and my parents would bring me down, and then when I got older, I started going down to the parade myself with my buddies when we were teenagers, and I honestly think that was the first time I did stand-up comedy was when I would take the train. The train from the city to my house was about 20 minutes. And I remember getting on the train like 2 years in a row and obnoxiously drunk. And, you know, we're getting on the train at like 6:30 at night. So it's all these commuters from Wall Street are going back to the suburbs. They got their suits and ties and they got their New York Times opened up. And then about a dozen of us get on. And we're, you know, all my friends were, you know, Killerin and McGovern and Bucci and all these mix. And and I used to walk up and down the aisles and I would roast the people on the train. And my friends would be sitting there howling. And I just pictured today, if I saw a 14-year-old or a 15-year-old that drunk, I would smack the shit out of this kid. I was the kid you wanted to smack the shit out of, but I was killing. I would destroy. And then we'd roll off the train at Tarrytown and walk home and, you know, chew a bunch of bubble yum and put Visine in our eyes and pretend we weren't shit-faced. Luckily, our parents were also shit-faced, so nobody knew the difference. And then my father, every year on St. Patrick's Day, it would start off with a party he would have at the Friars Club, where he was a member. It was all Jewish members, and then my father was the token Irishman. I said Jewish, right? Yeah. They're all Jewish. My dad's the token Irish guy. And he would have a St. Patrick's Day show. It was a party, and there was step dancers and fifes and bagpipes and singers, and people would get up and tell Irish jokes, and everybody wore green, and there was an open bar, and all the Jews from the club would come down, and they would hang out, and they loved it. They'd never seen anything like this before, and it was all my dad's Irish friends, and Don Buchwald was there every year, and Maureen Langan, and all the great New Yorkers, and me and my mom would sing this old Clancy Brothers song called Four Green Fields, and it's an old Irish fighting song about the four green fields with the four counties in Ireland and trying to reunite them after the English tore us apart. And we were, I'm telling you, there is not two worse singing voices in the history of the Americas as Pat Fitzsimmons and Greg Fitzsimmons. We were awful. But we would do it a cappella, no music. We would stand there in front of 150 people, and people would die laughing, and we played it perfectly straight, like tears in our eyes, emotional, and people thought it was the funniest thing in the world. I started doing it when I was probably like 9 years old, and I did it until my dad died. So I was probably fucking 23 when I sang it the last time with my mom. Anyway, so I say that only to say that the tradition continues. And as you mostly all know, I throw a St. Patrick's Day party at the Improv for like the last 15 years. I do it every year. It's not always on St. Patrick's Day. We did it on March 15th, 2 days early this year, because it was a Saturday night. Felt like a more fun night for people. And we had a crazy good lineup. The Improv took such good care of us. Me and my friend Laureen have a contest, who makes the best Irish soda bread, which sounds like an oxymoron. Best Irish soda bread. But we both have a recipe that's gone down through the ages. And we bring in loaves and loaves of bread. And the cooks at the Improv are nice enough to slice it up. And they butter it and they toast it. And they serve it to the entire crowd. 200 people all get Irish soda bread. And then we bring a few people on stage. And they're the judges. And they have a contest. And my bread won 2 out of 3 years now. And so I was very proud. More proud, though, that we had live music for the first time this year. And it was my daughter, JoJo, and my buddy Mikey Fitzgibbon, and me. It was really mostly them. I played a little bit of harmonica, but they were both on guitar, and they started out with U2, Sunday Bloody Sunday. Whole crowd was pumping their fists and singing along, and then we segued into the Pogues. There's a Pogue song called Dirty Old Town, and my daughter sang it like a fucking angel. It's the most heartbreaking, sad, working class song. And she sang it and Mikey played. And then we brought it home with a little shout out to the Californians in the crowd. They sang California Dreaming. The place was singing along. They were clapping their hands. And then the flute solo comes and my daughter whips out the flute and fucking nails the solo. The place went berserk, screaming. It was crazy. And she was so self-composed and confident. And I'm telling you, she's got like perfect pitch. Nobody in our family knew she could sing. And she's only been taking guitar lessons for like 6 months, playing perfect, strong chords. Anyway, I could not, you know, you think you're proud of your kids, but there's no times when you're more proud of them. She was so nervous for the last week, and yet she fucking did it. That's when you're proud of your kids, is when they are thinking about quitting, they want to quit, and she showed up, and she was brave, and she was nervous throughout the whole performance, did not miss a single beat, nailed it. And she was so happy with herself. And then Annie Letterman, who was supposed to go to Alaska, went to Alaska on Friday morning, did a show, and then wanted to be on my show so much that she then got on a red eye the same night back to L.A. for the Saturday night show. And she was a doll. She got there early, hung out with my family, went to the after party, like schmoozed everybody from the crowd, all my friends. Tim Dillon stopped in, closed it out, destroyed. Had a great hang backstage with him and Annie and Saul Trujillo, who's a great new comic that you should know about and check out. He destroyed. Eric Griffin was great. Dennis Gubbins did a nice job. And the whole night was a blast. So much fun. So thanks if you guys came out. If you didn't, definitely come out next year. And Bobby Lee, unfortunately, did not perform. He showed up. He was supposed to be the headliner. And he saw us singing, and he walked out. He said, I don't want to go on this show. So I don't know what that is, but that's what happened. If you were disappointed he wasn't there, take it up with him, not me. But luckily, Tim Dillon was on a plane heading to Columbus, Ohio, which was turned back to LAX when some lunatic lost his shit on the flight. So if it wasn't for that, Tim would not have been at my show. He just came down to hang out. And then he was nice enough to close it out. So that was very cool. And he's Irish, not Korean. So that was good. What else? Big shout out for my friend, Big J Hollingsworth, Big Irish J. He has got a new album out called Green Monster that John Tobin, our buddy, produced out of Boston. I think they recorded it at Laugh Boston. It's on iTunes. It premieres today. Very funny dude. Great guy. Such a great sense of humor. So check that out. And I got some dates coming up. I'll be in Hamilton, Ontario at Levity on March 26th. Toronto at the Comedy Bar March 27th. Pittsburgh at the Improv, March 28th to the 30th. Then I will be in Boston on April 4th and 5th. Torrance, Huntington, Escondido, Dayton, that's a new date. Tampa, Florida, Austin, La Jolla. All tickets at fitzdog.com. Come out, check out the new hour. It's great new material. Speaking of great material, my guest today is a fantastic comedian who's from the South originally. What is he from? He's from Tennessee, I believe. He's got that thick, syrupy Southern accent. Makes you think he's like a Republican, but in fact, he's a bleeding heart liberal. He's the author of the Liberal Redneck Manifesto, Dragon Dixie Out of the Dark. He wrote a bunch of stuff. He's done a ton of specials. There's a piece out in the LA Times today, as a matter of fact, a profile on him, which is very flattering and very nice. He produced this documentary called Inherent Good about Andrew Yang. And he's just a pleasure. He's been on Real Time with Bill Maher. I know you're going to love him. I certainly did. And here he is, Trey Crowder. Welcome.
Hey.
Trey Crowder, my guest, who's, mm-hmm. This is a guy who's out there, you're banging it out on the road, like me, we're working a lot of the same places, you're at mm-hmm. the Den Theater in Chicago, mm-hmm. and your social media presence is, blowing up.
Yeah, you know, it's going okay. I mean, yeah, I've been, just really, road dogging it for a while now.
Yeah.
You know, since I could, I started doing stand-up in 2010 in Knoxville, Tennessee, uh-huh. and, you know, it was going okay for living in Knoxville and also fucking around and having kids in my mid-20s, you know. So considering all that, I was pretty happy with how it was going.
Wait, so you've been married 15 years and you've been doing stand-up 15 years, so you basically started both at the same time?
Well, me and her, I've never done stand-up without a girlfriend, and it's the same woman. She was my girlfriend for like a year and a half before I got married. And also, so we've been married for, so my son will turn 14 this year, which means we have been married for 14 years. Cause it was that type of situation.
Sure. You're from the South. That's what you do.
Well, that's the other thing. I'm from a very small town in the South. And so like I was 25 at the time. And like all my buddies from my hometown, you know, were like, oh, what took you so long? What have you been waiting on? You know,
right.
But I also was doing stand up and all my comic friends were like, well, that's it for you.
Yeah.
You know,
like, it's hard.
We'll see you later.
It's hard to be a struggling comic who's married with kids. I mean, that's a lot of that's a lot of distraction because everybody else is staying out till 4 a.m. in a diner and drinking and, you know, obsessing during the day.
Yes.
And I think in a way it's good because you got to be a businessman right out of the gate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to learn how to handle your shit. Stay on top of it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, some guys would say to me or whatever, like back in that time after a show, they'd be like, you know, I think like if you didn't have like a wife and kids, you might have like a shot at really doing this,
whatever. Yeah.
And my position on that was always like, well, that's, you know, I mean, that's motivation to figure it out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like it's all the more reason to make it work. But then what happened is in 2016, I like went viral on the internet. It was Facebook at the time.
Uh-huh.
And that that got me an internet presence, which allowed me to start touring and, you know, quit the day job and move to L.A. and have, you know, failed sitcoms and all that fun
stuff.
Hey,
man, failed sitcoms have a nice little check behind them, though.
Indeed they do.
Yeah.
You can get in the, you know, in the guild and all that good good stuff.
Get some insurance, get a down payment on a house. Did you buy a house?
Yeah, just like this past year, one of the worst times to have done so. It's like, but I'm from, like, I just couldn't get over, because like I said, I'm from a really small town in the South, and like I just could not get over the sticker shock of it all when we moved here, which we went here, you know, in like 2017. Uh-huh. And it's like, I could have done it. And if I'd done it then, it would have been infinitely better.
Yeah.
But then, but finally, it was just like, well, you know, we got to, or we just never will. So this past year, we bought a house in Burbank. And I've been like touring like every single weekend since then.
Yeah, but dude, I bought a house 25 years ago in Venice Beach. And at the time, everybody's like, you're crazy. This market is out of control. It's so high. It always goes up. And the thing is, you're going to be living there. So all that matters is, what's your nut every month? Can you pay that? Mm-hmm. Then it doesn't matter if your prices are going up or down. It's your nut stays the same.
Well, I was asking like fancy people when I moved out here, like the president of Warner Brothers TV at the time and people like that, about like buying a house or whatever versus renting. And even people like with a lot of people at the time said versions of what you just said, where it was like, they're like, oh, this is some kind of bubble. This will have to pop soon. This will, you know, it can't go on like this forever. And then it just, you know.
I know people that have been priced out of the market because they've been sitting on the sidelines for 10 years thinking it's going to dip, and it just kept going.
Right.
You know, at the end of the day, like, there's nothing you can spend money on that's any better than a house.
Right.
To know you own the place, you can put a shelf up, you can knock a wall down, whatever you want to do. It's your house.
Yeah, no, it is like, it, you know, it's one of those like classic American, Americana type things. You know what I mean?
Did you really put an above ground pool behind your house?
Yeah, how did you know that?
Watched your special. I watched your clips. On. Really enjoyed it. Spent a nice afternoon.
Oh, thank
going
you.
Deep on you.
I appreciate that.
So you really did put an above ground pool?
That was at that. The above ground pool was at the house that we rented that we moved from to this one. So the house I bought, I did not do that. We put it in my landlord's yard or whatever. You know, we broke it down before we left. But yeah, we put an above ground pool back there. You know, we wrapped some bamboo shit around it. Made it, gussied it up a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, we're not animals.
No.
But yeah, and then it never really worked out great because like we ended up getting we got like a heater for an above ground pool, like a heating unit, because like we didn't understand that, you know, the way the weather works here or whatever, like it would only get, because it gets cold again at night.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Even the summertime, it like never, because like in Tennessee in the summer, if you got a pool or whatever, after a couple weeks of summertime, it's just warm from then until.
Yeah.
It cools off again.
Right.
And we didn't know that it wouldn't work like that here.
No, it's freezing every night.
I know, right. Yeah. And we didn't understand that. So then we ended up buying a heater for an above ground pool. And then by the time we had done that, the novelty had worn off and the boys didn't even want to fuck with it anymore. But they did both like learn to, you know, swim and be comfortable with
that's
water
good.
Stuff in that above ground pool. So it was, you know, it was useful in that way.
That's good.
But yeah, my whole existence is like being like, I'm definitely like the most trailer trashy person in like my Burbank neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas like I'm Mr. Hollywood fancy pants, you know, back home.
Or so you don't fit in either place.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm kind of a man without a country, but in my, like in our neighborhood, you know, like I got a Jeep Wrangler, but it's got all this sun damage on it, and it's all beat to shit. And, like, my wife immediately pulled our whole front yard up because she was going to do something else with it, but she just hasn't, so it's sitting there all fucked the whole time. We, like, mow our own yard and do all that stuff. The other day she asked our neighbor for permission to paint the side of our neighbor's, like, garage or shed that's, you know, butts up against our property or whatever. And the neighbor was like, yeah, that's fine. So just, you know, let me know when you get it scheduled, you know, when the workers are going to be here and all that, just so I know. And you know, we were like, what are you talking? You know, we were just going to do
it. Right.
You know, but people don't think about that.
Yeah. Can you let us know when the Mexicans will be arriving so we're ready for them? We hate to be surprised by the Mexicans.
Yes, we like to put it on the neighborhood Facebook page the day before, just so everybody knows how many Mexicans are going to be in the neighborhood and at what times.
That's hilarious. So did you do it yourselves?
I mean, we haven't yet. This was literally just like last week. Oh, okay. So that's the plan.
Yeah. Now, is she a redneck too? I mean, I say redneck?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm all for it. It's a weird thing because, like, I grew up in, like, I was a kid in the 90s in rural Tennessee. That was the height of Jeff Foxworthy and all that stuff. Right. And it was, like, in my hometown, it was just people were, like, you know, proud to be rednecks or whatever. They wouldn't have taken, like, offense to it or anything. And then, but I guess that's heavily dependent on where you're from and your sensibilities and all that shit. But I don't give a damn. I mean, you know, you call me anything. That's fine. But she's, again, relatively speaking, I think she's she's like the most California-y white woman that I ever met back there, because she fucking loves Lululemon and, you know, fucking yoga and Starbucks and all that type of shit. She's very, like, kind of, like, crunchy, but at the same time, compared to out here, I mean, no, she's definitely pretty white trash.
I love that Starbucks is your reference for, like, earthy, crunchy.
It is.
It's a fast food restaurant.
I know. But, I mean, that's what I'm saying. But it's like, my hometown, we didn't have any traffic lights or, like, any. We had a Dairy Queen, but we didn't have any McDonald's or anything like that. We got a Subway sandwich shop. It was, like, front page above the fold news.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah. Wow.
Which we do have. It's weird that we even have a newspaper, but it's literally one dude in his house who prints a news, but, like, it's fucking Deadwood or something.
Yeah.
Like, one guy who saved up for a printing press in the 80s or something like that, and he's been doing it ever since. So.
And it's just ad-supported, just local.
And local subscribers and stuff.
Right, right. Oh, I love that. Yeah. Do you still get a copy of it?
I do not. This isn't why I was going to say because, but this is not why. But what's funny about that is, like, like I said, Subway, front page, above the fold news. I got a guy who's a really good friend of mine. He was kind of like my older brother growing up, who, like, lives out here and is an aspiring actor and has done a bunch of, like, you know, commercial work and that type of thing. Or he'll show up as, like, the heavy on NCSI or something like that every now and then. And he's from my hometown too. And so, like, when he has done that, like, that also is front page news. You know, we only watch out for NCIS or whatever this week. Cause local boy is going to be on there. And, like, you know, I've been on HBO multiple times. I had a ABC send a crew to my hometown to do a thing there, you know, with me and because of them and all this stuff. And it's like,
this is for the development deal?
No, like, this was like a fucking, like, Dateline special. Like, you're not
really?
Yeah, like, kind of highlighting just how fucked up things are in my hometown, really, which I should have foreseen them not taking very well.
Yeah,
but either way, the point is, like, and I've, like, never been acknowledged my existence in the paper, probably because of the political nature of my presence.
Well, yeah, I mean, I get, would you say your town is just solidly red, or were you part of a small faction of liberal?
So it's weird because I guess it's kind of both, because, like, my hometown is weird because when I was growing up there, I would have described most people as apolitical.
Yeah.
Like, in the night, they was just kind of like, they're all full of shit, fuck them all type of thing.
Yeah.
But even, like, general elections, Clay County, Tennessee, up until 2008, don't know what that was about, but up until then, it was like a blue county, you know, in every general election. And now it's like hardcore, deep, ruby red Trump country.
Right.
In the night, there was, for years, there was a big clothing factory there, Oshkosh Bagosh.
They make the little cute overalls
and all that stuff. Yeah, the most whimsically named company to ever murder a whole town, because they left in the 90s and it just, like, wrecked my town completely.
Really?
And it's been, like, depression era levels of unemployment. And also, so what my kitschy little thing that I say, which is true, is that the job showed up forever and the pills showed up for good at the exact same time in the 90s. Like, that factory left right as OxyContin and Percocets and all that became a thing.
Right.
And the combination of that just, I mean, ruined my hometown. And then that also happened. So, like, it do everything. Like, the football team got shitty.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, everything went just off a cliff.
Did you have friends that got on opiates?
Oh, I mean, my mom's she's in recovery now, but, like, my mom was, I was basically raised entirely by my dad because my mom was, like, not only hooked on opiates, but she was also like selling them too, and got caught doing it and went to jail multiple times.
No
all that
kidding.
Shit when I was a kid. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. So we don't have, and then years later, and then we're all right now, you know, I do this, like, but you know, we're not like super close, cause she just wasn't,
yeah.
You know, she would show up to like, you know, take the guitar my grandma got me for Christmas to pawn it type
oh,
of thing.
Wow.
It's always like some white trash stories are a lot of fun.
Yeah,
and some
yeah,
of them
yeah.
are just
right,
sad.
Right.
So I don't know. But, was that type of thing. And my cousin, her sister, she died. My aunt's son, my first cousin, you know, OD'd and died. His like, and my family's like, every family in my town is like that. Like everybody's got people that are, you know, either got hooked on it and didn't make it out, or ended up in jail, or maybe they're okay now or not. But that's just like how
the thing I was amazed by is like, where do all the pills come from? Because if it's a small town, there can't be a lot of pharmacies.
It's funny you say that, because the way that like the pharmaceutical companies, they like, it's been like proven now, they like targeted communities like mine,
right,
for, you know, for like starting the spread of this whole thing or whatever, because
yeah.
It's like working class people that have a lot of aches and pains and that type of shit, and they
work in mines or manufacturing
or the
jobs,
right? Yeah, I mean, that's what happened to my, she worked at that factory, fucked her back up at the factory, went to a doctor who prescribed her, you know, Percocets or whatever, and then that was just that.
And that doctor had been coached by the pharmaceuticals.
He had been told these are miracle drugs, because
right.
The great thing is they're not addictive at all,
mm-hmm.
And like they told people that, and so it was like a very concerted effort, and a lot of people were making a lot of money off of it, because they were just giving them out like candy. So my hometown, which I already told you has no traffic lights and no fast food places or whatever, when I was a kid there, there was four different pharmacies in my hometown.
No shit.
And one time, Geraldo Rivera showed up with a camera crew, because they did a raid on those pharmacies, because they were all like crooked and, you know,
yeah,
giving out pills illicitly and that type of shit. So
right.
It's like, no, that I mean, that's there was no there should have been one mom and pop pharmacy,
mm-hmm.
period, but
right.
There was four, all in like nice buildings and shit, because they were just, you know, hooking everybody up, basically.
So what happens when those places get raided, get shut down, and there suddenly is a dearth is a lack, right?
Yep, dearth. Nailed
dearth
it.
Is a lack of pills available.
Right.
What do people do?
You know, well, now it's like, for a lot of people, a lot of places, it's like heroin, and then now fentanyl, that type of thing. Like, people replace it with that, so.
Is that what your mom did?
No, my mom she was real wrapped up in it in the height of all that in the late 90s and 2000s.
Yeah.
But she's been off of it. She's still, you know, she's still got her issues, but she's been off of that and out of jail since 2011
oh,
or something like
okay.
that.
Okay, got
so, you know,
it. Right.
So for a while.
Before the crackdown started and the
right. Well, what's weird about that, they had crackdowns and shit before, but then nothing would happen. Like,
mm-hmm.
the places would stay open.
Right.
The doctors would keep their license, and like nothing would change. It was weird.
Right.
Like, every now and then,
right.
like people, there'd be some big raid and everybody would hear about it.
Yeah.
But then nothing at all changed.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But they finally did really crack down on it. And I guess it is different now, but it's still, I mean, my town is still, even that notwithstanding, it's still pretty fucked there.
Did you ever fuck with it at all?
Not really, but I do kind of get it, because I went during that time period when I was 18, I had my wisdom teeth cut out. Right. And this was such a, like, this is one of those things where it's like, I'd never been anywhere else. I didn't understand what really my town and my life and everything was like. Like, I had no frame of reference for how crazy a lot of this shit was, or
yeah.
whatever. But like, there was no dentist or anything in my hometown that could do that. I mean, my wisdom teeth cut out, so there was these people, these dentists who like would come through in a van, right? Like a traveling van or
really?
Something.
Really?
That would come through town in a van.
Yeah.
And you'd know when they were coming, and you'd make an appointment, and they would like, you know, cut your teeth out of your
uh-huh.
head or whatever. And so I got my wisdom teeth cut out by the van dentist, right? And they like, they You have your wisdom teeth? Did you have them cut out or anything, or do you have?
I had
them,
one taken out.
Do you know how they like? Typically, they tell you about like the possibility of dry sockets and stuff.
Yes.
They're like, don't drink through a straw for this amount of time.
Yes,
keep them flushed and all this stuff because like they literally none of that.
Yeah,
like I just showed up, they knocked me out, cut my teeth out, and then like you know sent me on my way with a big old bottle of pills. Right?
Really?
So I was not told how to take care of any of that. So within a couple of weeks, it had all gotten infected.
Oh,
it was
Jesus.
Disgusting and awful.
And now you got no dentist in town to deal with it.
Right. And yeah, so I had to go to like the big town nearby where there's a mall and a movie theater to get that like...
The crazy city.
Right. Yeah, it really was like the city to me, uh-huh. But it's a place, it's called Cookeville, Tennessee. It's like halfway between Nashville and Knoxville, and it's... Uh-huh. There's a Cal College there. It's like a town of 30,000 people or something. But was like the major metropolitan area of Putnam County to me. But I went there and got that all dealt with. But they, like I said, they also gave me a big old bottle of pills. And at first, I was, you know, I mean, my shit was pretty fucked up at first. So I'm taking these pills because they help.
Yeah.
But then, you know, fast forward a week or two or whatever it is later, and it's like, this is pretty much okay now.
Uh-huh.
And I'm still taking these pills and just playing Dreamcast in my room.
Yeah.
You know, because they're pretty awesome.
They're awesome.
And then I ran out, and like I was up finally, and I went to, I'm so white trash. I also have a cousin named Trey. So my cousin Trey, I went to his trailer, cousin Trey's trailer, and that night to play Halo or some shit, and I'd run out of my pills, and his dad had a lingering back issue, so he had. He had a script, you know, and I knew that, and I never brought it up before.
Yeah,
but I get down there that night, and I'm like, hey, well, you know what we should do? We should like go in the kitchen or the medicine cabinet or whatever, and we should like grab some of your dad's pills, you know.
Uh-huh.
And he immediately was like, what the fuck? No, you know, because he had fucked me. And I genuinely, in my head at that moment, I was like, why are you being a dick about
this?
You know what I mean? Like, that's how I felt about it. I was like, it's
right.
They're right there.
Right.
Fucking, it'll be fun. Like, why are you being an asshole?
Yeah.
You know, and he the whole time was like, dude, what's wrong with you? He's like, we're not going to steal my dad's pills. So I like left in anger.
Really?
Yeah. And, but he refused to do it. So we didn't do it. So I had no access to him. And then after, I mean, I probably could have called my mom, but I didn't want to do that. So
you already knew your mom was in trouble with these kinds of pills. And yet, that wasn't like a red flag to you not to mess around with them?
I mean, it was. But once I got them, I knew it could really fuck your shit up.
Yeah.
But none of us yet knew the reality of like how they were presented. And meaning like, I knew that it happened to her.
Yeah.
But a doctor had given me these, right?
Right.
So I was like, so that's fine.
Uh-huh.
And I'm saying by the time I got to the end of it, in retrospect, I realized like clearly my brain, I wasn't thinking about it right.
Because
that's what I'm saying. It's like I didn't. So it fucks up the way you think
insidious.
And look at
things. It slides right in there.
It changes.
And then
the way
it rewires your brain.
Right.
Once it gets in.
And then I couldn't get in. A couple days later, I was like, what the fuck was that about? You know, I realized how crazy that was.
Yeah.
And that was it. That was my closest ever dalliance. But if he had been on board with that, you know, I mean, I might be like
so
all
you owe
of my
him a
cousins.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I got into a thing where I got shoulder surgery, and I'd always, you know, I've been off alcohol for 35 years. I quit when I was like 25 years old, and 23 years old when I quit, 24. And but I always, you know, took a lot of pills back then, did a lot of coke, and then I would occasionally take, you know, pills for pain. And when I did, I really responded. Like, I was like, wow, this feels, as an addict, you know, I just felt it.
Right.
So I got shoulder surgery about 10 years ago, and they prescribed me some Percocets, or I can't remember, it was hydrocodone. And then I had a second doctor. So the surgeon wrote me a script. Then my general practitioner wrote me a script. And then I went to, like, a therapist who wrote. So I was getting them from three places. And then I had a friend who could get them from a doctor. So I went like for 6 months where I was taking like three or four a day.
Yeah.
And I was in such denial.
Right.
that I was getting into trouble with this.
Right.
Because the problem is...
I have shoulder surgery. I have a problem. Doctors told me to do this.
Right. And the problem is it gets into your receptors, your endorphin receptors or your... whatever the chemical that makes you feel good.
Yeah.
You have receptors. Dopamine receptors. It clogs them up so that now you the normal dopamine your body produces doesn't get in because the drugs are in there and it's synthetic. And so you to withdraw means to not feel anything good until those clear themselves out, which is why it's so impossible to get off of them.
Right. How long ago was that, did you say?
Like probably 8 years ago.
Right. Because the other side of this is like these like mythical doctors, you just show up and you're just like, you know, like that famous Mulaney bit about like, oh, I'll just go there and I'll say, sometimes I get nervous on airplanes and they'll give you Xanax or whatever. And like my buddy Joe Zimmerman had a bit about like, he said he went to the doctor and told him, he's like, I think I have ADHD, you know, like talking about Adderall. And the doctor was like, well, let me ask you one question. Do you have insurance? And he was like, yeah, I do. And the doctor goes, yeah, you got it. Right. And I hear people talk. Yeah. And again, in my hometown, I know it was like that, but I've never had that experience. Like I go, like, I'm like nearly on my deathbed coughing with some sort of horrible bronchial infection or something like that. And I can't, and you know, maybe they just know like he's from a fucking an addict's bloodline. Like we can't trust him, but they just never,
he's got a camo hat on. Don't like give him any opiates.
Right. Yes, exactly. Like when I like need something, you know, like legit cough syrup or something like that, I can't get it because they're so, you know, they're so wary about that whole thing.
Right, right.
But then I hear people talk about it. And it's like every doctor I go to, it's just like, you have these, you should have these. Here's some of these.
No, I was in South Africa for Christmas and I had a
this
really
year?
Yeah, for 3 weeks. And I got a really bad chest cold on my way over and I started being able to like not breathe. So I went to the pharmacy and I asked for, I go, give me your strongest cough medicine. And they gave me this bottle. It said codeine on it.
Right.
And I knew I shouldn't fuck around with it, but I took it, and it did
feel
it fucking worked, and it felt really good.
I still, even after everything with my family and all that, I feel like, especially, you know, as you get older and everything, if you're really fucked up, if you're like, you're sick for real, you can't stop coughing, or like, you know, you're in genuine pain, you know, I think that responsible adults should be able to get and take that, and then it's up to them to not get, you know, hooked on it again, especially now.
Yeah.
But it's like it was just misrepresented to a lot of people. But.
Yeah. So your dad took over. Was he? Because did he have a? Did you have a stepmom or did he have a girlfriend or he just kind of stood up and took care of you?
He had one girlfriend right after they split up when I was 7. He had a girlfriend when I was probably 8 or 9, and then that was it from there. He got he ran the video store in my little town, which was a converted single wide trailer, you know, that he put these letters on, it said Crowder's on the side. So it was Crowder's Video. But again, it was the video store in that town. So we rented, and buddy, you know, the back room with the curtain where the big box pornos were at, like that's what kept the lights on, really. All these, all these Christians having to come in there one at a time and go right there and get their, you know.
Oh, that's hilarious.
So he was like a long haired, like weed smoking, jean jacket wearing fucking, you know, rock and roll hippie dude. Like he didn't fuck with the Lord. So I didn't grow up in church, which is weird for there.
Yeah.
And he liked, you know, he liked fucking David Lynch movies and David Bowie and that type of thing. So that's what started. You asked me if I'm like from a pocket or a faction of, you know, queers, but like I'm, but I am kind of, I mean, like a lot of people at the end of the day, I am sort of the way that I was raised to be, really, because again, he was very much an outlier in that town. And like I said, he didn't send me to church. A big part of that, I think, for him, his brother, his only sibling, my Uncle Tim, is gay.
Yeah.
And so, like,
oh, right, that was a big effect on you in terms of
not
liking the way the church treated gay people.
Right. So, yeah, well, I kind of didn't even grow up going to, when I was real little, I went to church and thought nothing up. It's like, oh, you know, coloring books with Jesus in them or whatever. And then because my parents got divorced and it was just my dad, he didn't make us go to church.
Yeah.
By the time I went back to church, because I had friends who were, they were like, oh, we're going to take a trip to Nashville Shores or whatever the church is. So it was like, well, that sounds fun. So and I tried church out at like 12, 13 or whatever. I knew that my Uncle Tim was gay, and I would like, you know, hear the stuff, you know, homosexuality being an abomination and that type of shit.
Yeah.
At that age. And that's when I was just like, well, I don't want to fuck with that. And when I told my dad, you know, he was just like, hell yeah, I don't fuck with it either. You know,
so your dad was totally cool with his brother. There was no...
No, they were very close. My dad died of pancreatic cancer in 2013, so he's been gone for a long time now. Yeah. Uncle Tim is still around, but they were very close. And they're like 6 years apart, too, but I mean, they were tight.
And how did the town react to your uncle's...
That's another thing that's weird about my... It's like, it's a weird place because, like, it is... very fucking crazy white trash redneck in so many ways, but at the same time, like, before that aforementioned factory left in the 90s, right, my uncle and his partner, my other uncle, my Uncle Tim and my Uncle Mike, right, they owned a deli together on the town square called the New Day Deli that they
the
ran.
New Day Deli?
New Day Deli, yeah. That they ran together.
Yeah.
And everybody knew they were, you know, a gay couple. And it was like, the deli did well. It was popular. Like, uh-huh. A lot of people out there. And it was fighting. Like, nobody ever threw a brick through his window.
But they did call it like the New Gay Deli behind their
I'm
back.
I'm sure that's, of yeah, course yeah, they yeah. did. Yeah, right. Well, that definitely, because, I mean, I got, you know, fucking... like uncle, like nephew. Because, like, I liked books and shit.
Uh-huh.
Super gay.
Yeah.
You know, so, like, that plus a gay uncle's, like, I got a lot of it, but like I
like
said.
Like, mean-spirited or teasing?
I mean, both.
Yeah.
There were some, like, real redneck dumbass motherfuckers who I think also just kind of resented me. Because I was also, like, the smart kid in my school. Uh-huh. I liked books, but I, like, made good grades, and I was a smart kid in my school, which I realize now, looking back, I realize that's like being the straightest dude at a Cher concert or something. Like, it's not,
yeah,
it's, the bar is pretty low. It's not that impressive. But I didn't know that. And at the time, I mean, I thought I was hot shit intellectually.
Yeah.
Like, I graduated that school truly believing that I was like Goodwill Hunting.
Uh-huh.
Like, I thought I was that type of genius.
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, frankly, to be fair to them, I was definitely pretty pompous and I, you know, like, I just thought I didn't think I was smarter than everybody. I was utterly convinced of the fact that I was way smarter than everybody else around me, you know.
Do you think, like, part of it was just that is there a culture there where studying is not acceptable or cool?
Yeah, well, it's definitely not cool. I mean, it's like acceptable, I guess, but like,
But the cool kids are more into sports.
100%. That's the only thing that's cool is playing sports.
Right.
And so, like, and I played sports and also let a lot of the athletes cheat off of me, right? Like, cheat off my copy my homework and stuff. So, like, my school was so small, there's no cliques like you see in high school movies and
Not
stuff.
Not enough people for cliques?
No, there's you're either popular or popular-ish, or you're not.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's all there is.
Uh-huh.
And I was one of the... I was in, like, the popular group because my best friends were the captain of the football team and the homecoming
king. Because you let them cheat.
Because I let them copy off of me, and also because I was funny and all that shit. And I was on the teams, but I was not good, you know? But that's how I, like, survived. But in, like, middle school... Socially, I mean. But in middle school and shit, people would, like... A kid, they literally would be like, Trey fucking, you know what he thinks is fun is reading. He reads books for fun. That's what, like, that type of shit.
Yeah, yeah.
And would call me gay.
What about the girls? Did you get any girls?
They were like, they were like the worst about that.
Uh-huh.
Like, there was this group of girls. It's so pathetic. But I got, like, kind of bullied by a group of girls. They would chant, because of the, like, reading for fun thing and all that stuff, they would chant, Trey is gay. My name rhymes with gay. Trey, and I've got a gay uncle. Trey is gay. Trey is gay. And not in the happy way. That's how they would, that's what they came up
really?
With. Yeah, and that was the girl, like, the dudes were cool, mostly. With the girl.
So were you a virgin until you got out of high school?
No, I was a little
picked
bit.
Picked off a stray?
Yes. Also, this, again, some of the shit that's true about my background is wild, how white trash it is. The girl that I lost my virginity to, later, her dad would murder my uncle in cold blood for a completely unrelated thing.
Different uncle.
Yes, not Uncle Tim. My Uncle Bubbles, rest in peace.
This is your father's brother?
No, it's my mom's. It was my aunt. It was my aunt's husband. My mom. So it was like my uncle-in-law, but they were like together my whole life. He was always like great to me, but he was like, both of those dudes were not great. Like, my Uncle Bubbles was in and out of prison my whole childhood and was like a motherfucker, you know? Like, he literally, just any kind of redneck criminality bullshit you can come up with, he was involved with. But the dude, the girl that I lost my virginity to, her dad, the guy that killed him, he also was a huge piece of shit. So
was it like a drug deal gone wrong or something?
It's way dumber than that. It's like my younger cousin and her, me and her, I was already gone when all this happened. And me and her had nothing to do with each other in a long, long, so I'm completely separate from this, but it's a small town. Her younger sister and my younger cousin, my uncle's son, had been a couple, and then like there was drama between them, cheating and a breakup and whatever else, and that led the dads to start shit with each other over a high school relationship. Yeah.
No.
So
he killed a guy over his child's breakup?
Yes, but I think, this was like 20 something years ago. Okay. So we should put allegedly in front of all
allegedly.
Of this.
Okay, allegedly. Right, right.
Because I don't want, because this is like, we're talking about murder and slander and stuff. I know I haven't said any names here, but still, I mean, other than Bubbles. But I guess the story was they were talking a lot of shit to each other and the whole thing. Bubbles was like, I'll come out there, motherfucker, and like went to his house and had a gun on him. And he's now on this guy's property with a gun. And then the dude shoots him.
Which
whatever.
Is the right to stand your
right,
ground.
Yeah,
and
exactly. That's
kind of say.
The version of it that I always was given to believe. You know, I don't know exactly how it shook out, but just, you know, crazy white trash shit. But his daughter that I lost my virginity to, I think I was 16, like halfway to 17 or something, because I finally figured out. I also, on top of all this, I was a fat kid, right?
No.
Yeah, big time. And,
God.
And in high school.
Way to bury the lead on that one. You should have told me that earlier.
A fat dork. And I'm still a doughy motherfucker, but I mean, I was like a fat kid. And in high school, around that time, I got a big growth spurt. And also, if this is true, realized that liquids had calories in them, because I did not know that. And like I said, I was the smart kid in my school, too, but I didn't realize that. I thought only food could make you fat.
So soda you're talking about.
The year before I actually lost weight, I had, tried to just stop eating as much. I was basically starving myself, and I wasn't losing any weight. And I was like, what the fuck is going on? I was very frustrated by it. And one day, I came home from school, and I did the same thing I did every day when I got home from school, which was I went to the refrigerator, and I pulled out the bottle of Sunny D, right?
Yeah.
And just, you know, took 3-4 big plugs of it, shoved it back in there. This day, when I shoved it back in there, the back of the bottle was facing me.
Yeah.
The nutrition information.
Oh, okay.
I shoved it back in there, went to close the door, and I was like, what the fuck? And I grabbed it and looked at it, and I was like, no way.
Yeah.
It said, you know, one serving of Sunny D's, 180 calories or whatever it was. And I was like, why didn't somebody tell me? This is crazy. And so then I stopped drinking everything but water or booze if I was at a party.
Yeah.
But I stopped drinking sodas, sugary drinks, any of that shit.
Yeah.
And I had a growth spurt, so like sophomore to junior year, those two things combined, I lost like 40 pounds and shot up 6 inches.
Yeah.
And so that helped a lot. I was still a fucking, you know, smart kid nerd or whatever.
Yeah.
But
I'm guessing this girl you lost your virginity to wasn't slim either.
No, not particularly.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, Salina Slim, you know. Okay. Salina Slim. Yeah. That was actually her dad's name. He was a riverboat gambler and a criminal, Salina Slim. That's not true.
So your dad, were you guys close then?
Very.
Do you have siblings?
Yeah, I have one younger sister.
So your dad, I just can't believe your dad was able to step up like that and raise two kids on his own and put you through college and grad school. Or I mean, maybe he didn't pay for it, supported you through it.
And also all like comedy and stuff too, because like I said, because he ran the video store and shit.
Yeah.
His dad, my grandfather, was like really the patriarch of the family, and he was an old gearhead who like built and raced stock cars in the 50s and 60s and shit, and now he owned a garage and a car lot and all that shit. All of which also closed when the factory left.
Yeah.
But he was like a real man's man type dude, but he had the position of like, he knew I was smart and make good grades, and he was like, that's good. You're not going to do any, like, grease monkey shit. He was like, you can do whatever you want to do. But what he meant by that was, like, I could be a lawyer or a doctor. You know, I could do some fancy businessman stuff or whatever because I was smart. And so when I'm, like, a teenager or whatever, and I tell him I want to do comedy and show business, you know, he's just like, he's like, fucking what?
Yeah.
Are you, he's like, no, you've got a golden ticket. You're throwing it away. What are you doing?
Yeah.
But my dad the whole time was like, I think that'd be cool as hell, boy. Like he was hippie. He was very on board with it.
Yeah.
And so he was, he couldn't have been more supportive. We had no money. And yeah, I mean, I put, you know, I had like a bunch of grants and scholarships and stuff to get through college. And I worked the whole time too. But but like emotionally and all that, he couldn't have been more supportive. He was like, I mean, that's me and my sister talk all the time about how like we're statistical outliers in a lot of ways, like where our like background and everything, and where how we are not dead or in jail or hooked on drugs and all that type of shit.
Yeah,
but like, I mean, the truth is that's pretty much entirely because of my dad. Like, if my dad had not done that and been that way, then I, you know, I probably would be, you know, turned out the same way as a lot of my cousins did.
And so you grew up on the sort of on the border of Kentucky and Tennessee.
Yeah.
And what is the difference between those two states? Because a lot of us don't know.
Well, I mean, where I'm at, so, like, that's north middle Tennessee and south middle Kentucky.
Yeah.
I mean, fucking literally nothing.
Yeah.
Like, this side of the line, it's, you know, Big Blue, and this side of the line is Go Vols. You know, and that's really about it. But generally, Kentucky is a lot more nuanced of a state, in my opinion, than Tennessee is. Like, parts of Kentucky are very, like, East Kentucky coal country shit is, like, hillbilly as hell, and it's very much, like, the South. And, like, the part that I grew up across from, it's the fucking South, you know? But as you get up into Kentucky, and also they, you know, they were neutral in the Civil War and all that. They weren't part of the Confederacy.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
They were one of the three or four... They were a slave state, but were not part. They didn't secede, so they're not in the Confederacy. So it's like, you know, it's a.
So their slaves weren't as tightly guarded. They were like free range.
I actually think it's more like they just because they were cool with because they didn't secede at first. The Union was just like for a minute. They were like, we'll let them have slaves for a second and they, until they couldn't anymore.
Yeah.
But so because of all that,
but then you got like Lexington, which is
Louisville, Lexington, all that up there is like. It's
horse country.
There's people with money and horses and stuff. It's more basketball than football oriented. And like Louisville, I was just in Louisville, and like I like Louisville a lot. But
love Louisville.
It doesn't. It does not feel like you know like a southern city or anything to me.
No.
But parts of Kentucky, whereas I mean Tennessee is just. I mean it's the fucking South all the way through it.
Except Nashville.
Well, yeah, I mean, but I found that. I mean, even this, even Nashville. Nashville is where like frat boys from Ohio go to cosplay as a redneck or whatever.
Right,
do you know
right.
what I mean? So it's like it. They got a whole kitschy fucking cowboy hat and you know boots type yeehaw thing.
And all the women are there on bachelorette parties, dressed up in Daisy Duke shorts and cowboy boots.
Right, and they do all that because of how you know it's like we're going to the South for a thing.
Right,
so, I mean,
right.
But I mean, yes, the city, you know, like Memphis is fucking black as hell, obviously.
Yeah.
And not at all redneck, but still Southern in a black Southern type of way. And like there's, I've found that most states in this country, the cities are, you know, different than the other parts, obviously.
Right.
Like when I drive, there's parts of California I drive through that look like, I mean, maybe not topographically, but culturally look like, you know, parts of the middle of nowhere in Tennessee too, or whatever.
Right. So, yeah. So which brings us to, your politics coming out of there. What's it like when you go on the road? I mean, I assume you attract most of your audience, but there also must be a certain percentage of passive people. Say you're playing Chattanooga, Tennessee, which I think is coming up on your calendar.
It is. Yeah.
Then you go into a place like that. Say 20% of the people come in because it's the Chattanooga Comedy Club and they don't know your politics. Do you get pushback, and how do you deal with that?
Yeah, so that whole thing is definitely a thorn in my side because, like, I even in front of my, like, regular – if I know it's just all my people, right, I still don't – I would say 80-plus percent of the stuff that I try to do is not, like, overtly political or whatever. But I have this thing in my head where it's like, I want to give people, you know, I want to give them what I think they came for.
Well, because your internet following is much more political.
It's very, yeah.
Right.
Right. And so what I typically try to do generally is like, I'll start right out the gate with like 10-ish minutes of stuff that's pretty overtly political, you know, to just, so people that came to see me are like, oh, he's doing the thing. He did the thing. And then after that, I just talk about whatever I want to.
Yeah.
But I try to have a read on what you're talking about, and sometimes it works out better than others, where it's like, sometimes I'm in a club, because I'll do, like in Chattanooga, that's like a smaller-ish theater. Like sometimes it's theaters and not clubs.
Yeah.
And those people, they're not getting a lot of like passive,
right,
just regular. Those people I'm
actively fans
are
of yours.
Fans of mine that are right there to see me, so I'm not worried about it.
Yeah.
And then in some clubs, I, you know, if I have a sense that I'm getting a good number of those people, I, you know, I try to fucking rein it back in.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I don't want.
Does it happen though?
Yeah. Oh yeah, it happens. Yeah.
And how do you deal with that?
Well, I say it's happened. Luckily, so far, it's happened in a way. It's like, you know, every now and then I'll walk a table
sure.
or something.
But they quietly walk.
Yes, so far. I haven't.
Which I love. I love quietly walking
right.
a table.
Yeah, that's fine with me.
Yeah.
But I haven't. I mean, the type of heckling I get and stuff usually is like drunk fans of mine that are like overly excited.
So, you know, yeah, because
something.
I found that. First of all, I respect that you still do it at all, because I know a lot of comics, they talk a good game when they're in L.A. or New York, and then they go down to the Houston Improv, and all of a sudden they're not doing the same material. And it's like, well, your material should be strong enough that you can do it no matter where you are. Your jokes should work. They should be, you know, mathematically good jokes.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important that you do that. And I think that there's more of a fear of backlash than a reality of it. I think it's pretty rare that somebody with a MAGA hat is going to yell up, you
right.
know, make America great again, like after one of your jokes. Like most people just go with it. They may not like it. They may leave, but they don't really yell that much.
No, I agree. I mean, that's been my experience too. And yeah, I tried it. Like I said, a lot of like, again, the stuff I do at the very top, if I'm on a tour show in front of my people, the first 5 or 10 minutes is going to be, you know, pretty overt, but a lot of the stuff that I talk, and I've always been this way too. Like even that's another thing too that's wild is like, so I started in Knoxville and then in the surrounding areas, Chattanooga, Nashville, Atlanta, all that
right,
stuff.
Right, right.
15 years ago, and back then, do like the most fucking whatever edgy or punk rock type thing you could do would be like bits that I guess people would call woke now, but
yeah.
you know, making fun of the Bible, shitting on the Bible, or doing
uh-huh.
a pro-abortion joke or
yeah.
pro-gay jokes and that type of thing.
Right.
And it was like, you know, again, that made you a fucking firebrand then
right.
and there. You were like pushing the envelope.
Uh-huh.
And so I did that. And now it's like a completely different everything. Just the context and, you know, now it's like pandery or whatever.
Right.
But I try to do things that are like I got a whole big chunk right now that I'm doing about the idea of woke schools,
uh-huh.
right? Woke public schools.
Right.
And I talk about I went to a public school and how not woke it was. My
uh-huh.
sons go to a public school out here and it is woke,
yeah.
right? And it's the type of stuff that I really do think that like generally it is like, it's talking about stuff, but it's something that I would do in front of a mixed audience or general audience or,
yeah.
you know, like I was in Springfield, Missouri early recently, and Kyle Kinane was at the club I was at the next night.
Uh-huh.
And so the night before I went and did spots on his show, you
yeah.
know, and it's his audience, but most of them don't know who I am or
yeah.
whatever. And I tried a bunch of that new stuff that, you know, cause I want to make sure that it's like, yeah, that it's not just, I hate the idea of, I mean, pandering one, but clapter especially.
Yeah.
Like I try to,
right.
Cause I think it can be two different things. Like I'm not going to lie. There's some stuff I do every now and then that I know is kind of pandery, but I still do think that it's funny or like there's a funny joke in it, you know,
well,
like
I just
top,
think
but like clapter is like, it's just saying something that people agree with.
Right.
And
right.
There's no joke at all. And I try genuinely very hard to not do that.
And I also think that the way you broach the subject, you know, obviously some people are more likable than others. So if you're a likable comic, you can usually take the crowd places that they wouldn't normally go.
Right.
But it's also about not yelling out platitudes and going, walking on and going, well, Trump's a fucking asshole and here's why. It's like, no, go to the here's why.
Right.
And then if they want to extrapolate whatever they want from it, they can. Obviously, your point of view is going to come through, but you're not making them sign on to the premise at the beginning. Or reject the premise at the beginning.
Right.
You know, there's ways of doing it. And I do a lot of anti-gun jokes in the Deep South. And I see people and I know my rhythm has to be a little faster at that beginning. When I'm introducing that I'm anti-gun, don't give them a window or they will take it.
Right, yeah. Yeah. That's, I mean, I got a reverse, like, so I have a thing, I talk about my son's school or whatever, and I talk about how they have a land acknowledgement, like an office or whatever, which is where, and I genuinely think that a lot of people in other places, like, don't know what that is,
right?
So I say it's like, that's like where they start the day off by saying, we acknowledge that the land we are on was unjustly taken away from the indigenous peoples of the insert tribes here, depending on where you're at geographically, right? And a lot of times, my crowd, people will, like, clap for that, you know, just because they're like, that's a great thing to do.
Yeah.
But what I say right after that is like, which I mean, I get what they're doing, but I can't help but find it a little bit funny because I feel like the underlying implication of that is, I mean, don't get me wrong, we're still going to keep it. Like, we're not,
exactly.
Like, you can't just have it back. All of our stuff's here.
You know? We're just giving a shout out.
So it's like, sometimes people will, like, I'm explaining it and people will, like, clap at that part, but then the joke itself is like making fun of performative wokeness or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, so, yeah. And it's also like I have an abortion joke that seems like it's going to be pro-choice, and it's actually kind of an indictment of how lazy people are about getting an abortion, you know, and how entitled they are to the abortion instead of like, wait. And so, and I love catching women in that trap. Or I'll say like, God is whatever you want God to be. God's a manifestation of whatever you think the higher power is. And like, God can be a man or a woman. Like, my God's a woman. And then women clap and I go, she's got big tits and she's quiet. And you just see the smile turns into a frown.
Right. Yes. No, yeah, I love that. And I try to do versions of that, you know, type of thing.
Also. All right, I want to get into Fast Dogs. Oh, for Trey Crowler. I wrote Crawler.
Yeah, Trey Crowder.
We got it right. I want to talk a little bit about the sitcoms, because you've had three deals now. Are they all the same idea and different executions of it?
The three deals that I had, yes, were. I also sold another sitcom that I worked on with some other people that had nothing to do with any of that, none of which ended up going. But, like, I had three development deals that ended up in network sitcoms that, yes, were the classic, like, comedian gets a sitcom about it. So, like, semi-autobiographical.
Right.
Most of them had some version of, like, I'm moving back to a version fish of out of my water. Hometown.
Right, right.
And you know, he's a fish out of water, even though he's from here.
Right.
And that's kind of the setup. And then I sold a show to Amazon that I didn't have a development deal for, that I just worked with these people on, and it was had nothing to do with me. It was like a country music show.
Right.
The ones from the deals were same. Yeah.
Yeah.
Versions of the same thing.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I mean, everybody says they're looking, everybody in development says, we're looking for a strong point of view. And it's like, well, you fucking have one. You should have a show.
Tell me about it. I've been thinking that for a long time. You hear the stuff about the point of view, and it's like, well, my point of view, it's like people, executives and stuff, I mean, I think they like the idea of it or something.
Yeah.
And then they don't know exactly how to deal with the reality of the whole thing. You know what I mean? They just don't really know what to do. Because it's so... The world I'm trying to represent, especially in shows that are like set in like versions of my hometown and shit, it's just so fucking alien to these like Hollywood studio executives, you know, that like they don't, I mean, they can't connect with it, but they don't understand why I think it's funny, or they'll
play Mayberry.
They'll be like, is this right? It's like fucking, you know, pill addicted white trash Mayberry. It's like, fucking, you know, the Mayberry in hell.
Right.
And they're just, you know, they don't get things, but also they'll be like, is this real? You should tone this down. And they'll be like, I already did tone that down before I even put it in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Like that type of shit is what I just kept running into.
All right, top three Southern comedians of all time.
Jesus, of all time? Man, that's hard. You put me on the spot. I mean,
comedians.
My guy, love him. I'm going to put Roy Wood Jr. at the top right now.
Yeah.
Because I love Roy from Alabama. Think he's awesome. And these are, if you asked me tomorrow, I'd have a different list. But the first ones that, like, popped into my head, I guess. Let's see. I mean, look, I grew up loving Foxworthy. He's like the redneck Seinfeld or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, he's like our guy.
He's amazing.
So I owe a lot to him.
I'm
going to
see
probably,
him next week.
Probably Ron White, you know.
Yeah. Fuck yeah. Yeah. How about Theo Von? Are you friends with him?
Yeah, I know and love Theo. Yes, yeah. He's great.
Right.
Yeah. Again, I just, you know, thought of those three guys first. But Theo, I think Theo's one of the funniest human beings alive.
So fucking funny. I mean,
he's crazy funny.
Yeah, he really is. He's just like got something special. You can't fake that kind of funny.
Right.
And then what about Andy Griffith?
The actor or the show or the
well he was a comedian
yes he was
yeah.
yes right you're right yes I mean I know the football bit what
uh-huh.
it was football
yep
yeah I don't I've always heard that he was like a pretty big dick
oh really
yes right yeah
that's hilarious
I've just heard I'm not saying it's true I don't know but allegedly that's what I'd heard I met this like old boy who was like a roadie for a fucking Southern rock band for years who had a story about meeting him when he was a kid and Andy Griffith well, he's like eight and Andy Griffith telling him to go fuck himself at 8 years old or whatever but that's not the only I've heard other stuff like that too so.
I wonder what Opie has to say about him
mm-hmm. yeah Ron Howard
yeah
I don't know it's a good question I've never heard him talk about him
he doesn't talk shit about people that's why he's lasted so long in this business
right
are we gonna do a thing now called Fastballs with Fitz
okay
you ready
Yeah. See how my swing is. Probably not great.
What's the last fist fight you've had?
College in a bar over a stupid girlfriend I had at the time who she was being obnoxious and started, you know, and some dude told her to stop and I told him to, you know, go fuck himself or whatever. And then I had a bunch of guys with me, I had a bunch of guys with him. So it just devolves into a fucking one of those like cartoon smoke cloud melees, like immediately, but briefly before, you know, bouncers jump in and throw us all out. I don't even remember what she did, but remembering that girl, like it was definitely
the way that party started. I thought you were going to say, so I punched her in the face. Much better.
Now that, well, in retrospect, I mean, I would have been all right with that if one of them had done it. You know, she kind of looking back, she didn't not deserve it.
Yeah.
But at the time, you know, what was I going to do? But yeah, that was in fucking Panama City, Florida. Where else?
Was it a spring break thing?
Yes, spring break.
Everybody's looking for a fight.
Right.
The
tiki bar at the Sandpiper Beacon. Shout out to one of the most trashiest degenerate places on earth.
The problem is with spring break is that guys have this vision of going down there. They've seen movies, and there's tons of chicks in bikinis.
Mm-hmm.
And you get there and you realize there's five guys for every girl, and they're mostly football teams.
Yes.
So you don't stand a chance.
Right. That's true. The dudes that I was with in that bar, they were football players, and the other guys probably were too. So it's also one of those things where it's like, if these dudes hadn't been with me, I might have just been like, get your fucking shit together. What are you doing?
Yeah,
don't talk shit to that guy. You see how big that guy is?
Yeah, you look at him and go, what's with this bitch?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Let's see. Have you ever borrowed a lot of money? We talked about college.
You like from anybody?
Yeah.
I mean, like, so not a mortgage, not a car.
No, note. No.
I mean, no. I've always been real proud about, like, I've been, like, totally financially independent since I was 18. And also something about the way that I was raised, the way that I am, I have, like, a deep-seated aversion to asking people for stuff.
Yeah.
Or for help or just for anything.
Right.
Right, I know. I'll take care of myself. I'll be all right, type thing. So, I don't think I've ever borrowed, you know, more than like, oh, I forgot my wallet. Give me $40 for this.
Have you lent anybody a lot of money?
I mean, you count my mom.
Yeah,
but I don't consider it lending because I know it's never coming back.
Yeah, right.
So I just give her a lot of money. So yeah.
When's the last time you apologized to somebody?
My wife just got back from a trip, so probably today, but I can't remember what it would have been about. I'm not gonna lie, I'm a very like I must have some like Canadian in me or something, because I'm quick to default to like, yeah, you're right, I'm sorry. I'm sure I was being a dumbass about something. It's also, like I said, I don't like asking people for stuff. Part of that is I don't like to feel like I'm putting people out. Uh-huh. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like on the road and shit all the time, you know, I'll be like, hey, I'm gonna be there, you know, a little bit later than I thought I was. I'm real sorry about that. You know, it'll be like that type of thing.
Yeah,
like
right,
I'm constantly
right.
apologizing for little shit that I don't really need to.
Okay.
But it's just part of my whole thing. And so if it's like a big, legit thing, I'll probably apologize too early, you know? Like, she probably thinks that I must not mean it because I dove into it too fast or whatever.
Yeah.
You know? But I'm always just like, let's just skip to the part where, you know, I was wrong and we moved past it. Like, I'm okay with having been wrong.
Well, that's a different kind of apology. That's a pragmatic apology.
Yeah,
as opposed to on a deep level wanting to make amends about something.
All right. Yes, right. So a very sincere, I'm sorry for the way I went about this type of thing.
Yeah.
The first thing that comes into mind, not a fun story, is I had a friend that I made a remark to about how everything was coming up, that his family, like everything's going so great for you guys, because he just mentioned getting a promotion or something like that, when I knew but wasn't thinking about the fact that his wife had a miscarriage recently.
Oh.
And I said that in front of all of them, you know, and then as soon as I did, you know, and so I was like, immediately I was like, hey, just so you know, that was I'm an idiot. I shouldn't have done that.
In front of everybody, you apologize?
Yeah, like right off the bat, as soon as I realized it.
So
that's the first thing that popped in my head.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good save. Yeah. Because if you do it later, then it's like you didn't deal with it. You let him sit with those feelings for a while as opposed to remedying it immediately.
Right.
Even though it would be more face-saving to do it later, you did the manly thing. And apologize in the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to think that I'm pretty good about recognizing and acknowledging when I've been wrong about something.
Yeah.
The flip side of that is, if I'm truly convinced that I'm right about something, buddy, you talk about fucking righteous indignation. Like, I won't, like, nothing makes me madder than being told or accused of being wrong about a thing that I know that I'm right about.
Right,
you know what I mean?
Right.
Where it's like, I know that I'm on the right side of this, and the other person is acting like I'm not, drives me fucking insane.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Have you ever not finished a set on stage?
No, I don't think so.
Hmm.
I don't.
Interesting.
I don't think. I mean, maybe. No, I don't think so. What, you have a story for that?
I got hit in the chest with an apple while opening for They Might Be Giants at an outdoor show at a college.
Yeah.
And I said, all right, take it easy, everybody.
I was just with some comics doing shows, and we were talking about, have you heard Larry Miller tell that story about going to that, like, Indiana Highway Patrolman's dinner that it's like a corporate.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't tell him. He didn't know this. He just shows up thinking he's the entertainment for the night. But before his set starts, they do a memorial service for a fallen brother in the highway patrol who had just died in like the last 2 weeks. And his
Jesus.
Widow and two small children were there.
Oh, no.
And they had them on stage and had a slideshow and all this stuff. And so they played this sad music and not a dry in the house. Everybody's crying. And at the end of it, he's like, all right. And now the comedy stylings of Larry Miller, right? And his point to the whole story is like, he's like, you know, and the thing is, like, it would never enter your mind to not do that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? To just be like, hey, we're not doing this.
Uh-huh.
He's like, it never occurred to me not walk up there. It's
no,
just like,
soldiers.
Well, I gotta do it. So you do it. And it's like, I was just talking with a bunch of comics this weekend about that. But it is like, it's like, you know, getting hell gig situations, whatever. And you're like, well, I'm just going to go eat shit for this amount of time.
Yep.
And then be mad about it.
No, we're fucking soldier. I was just talking to Paul before the show about how, like, I don't know that I've ever missed in 35 years. I don't know that I've missed a show because I was sick.
Right.
You just do it. Right. It doesn't occur to you to go, oh, I can't do it. No, because all of us struggled starting out, and we were so hungry and desperate for stage time that I've never taken it for granted ever since.
Yeah, no, same thing. I don't think I've ever missed one. Well, when I was still in Knoxville, and so 3 or 4 years in, I came back from a Bonnaroo once, and I was just whatever I ate or all the drugs and the combination thereof, it felt like food poisoning.
Yeah.
Like I was fucked up bad for a couple of days. And one of those days I was supposed to have a show, and I had to tell the guy, I was like, dude, I'm sorry, but I can't get off the couch.
Yeah.
And I think that's the only time in 15 years I've done that.
Not bad.
When I have to cancel a show for like some legit reason, some like TV thing or something.
Yeah.
You know, like I hate myself for that.
Right.
You
right.
know, let alone just because I, you know, couldn't do it.
Right.
You know.
All right. Finally, what is the hackiest bit that you've ever done?
I had early on, one of my closers was a bit about, I had a bulldog at the time, an mm-hmm. English bulldog. It was a bit about watching him poop, mm-hmm. you know, and he's like real struggling. He's up on his, you know, his like tiptoes or whatever. And
would you act out the tip?
And then also take my hand, my finger, and put it right here and be like, and then his little lipstick starts poking out, his little red rocket, you know what I'm talking about. Fellas, that's what I said. Then I get stuff like, fellas, I've taken a lot of good shits in my day. I ain't never shit my dick hard, boys.
There's going to be a night. Now that I've made you bring that bit up, you're going to be having a bad set in the next 6 weeks, and you're going to pull that bit out at the end just to get yourself off stage. Don't miss Trey Crowder, not Crawler, as I wrote in my script. He is just a great stand-up. You're special. When did that special come out?
I think the one you saw was the last one, but my next one's coming out in like 2 weeks, March 13th. Oh. Trash Daddy.
Okay.
What's called.
That's great.
Yeah.
And it's going to be on what?
On YouTube, 800 Pound Gorilla's YouTube page or YouTube channel.
Why not put it on your own channel?
Because they, they made it. They shot it and everything.
Did they pay for it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
He's going to be coming to you March 1st in Fort Lauderdale, March 2nd in Tampa.
Tampa, yeah.
The March 7th and 8th in Minneapolis, March 21st in Portsmouth, then Boston, Binghamton, Austin, Lowell, Knoxville, Chattanooga,
mm-hmm.
Eugene, Portland, Houston, Vegas, Tulsa, La Jolla. Go to Trey, T-R-A-E, Crowder.com to get tickets. And also check out the podcast. He's got two of them. One is called the Well Read, W-E-L-L-R-E-D podcast. The other one is called Putting on Airs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you put a lot of great material out there. I'm glad things are going so well for you. Very happy for you. We share an agent.
We do. Yes, we do.
Who we love. Valentine Sloot.
Yeah. But I'm a big fan and have been for a long time. I mean, I was a comedy nerd before I ever even started, and I think still am.
Yeah.
So I've been a fan of yours for a long time, and I appreciate you having me.
Nice to hear, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
All right. God bless.
All right. Thank you.
Owning a boat comes with a number of perks, like being able to fling your favorite fishing rod around. And here's another perk. GEICO's boat insurance covers your boat and your belongings. And with specialist support from agents that are as passionate about boating as you are, there's so much value that you'll want to high-five someone. But not while you're holding your fishing rod. That's a prized possession. So hold on tight with both hands and keep it covered through boat insurance. Get more with GEICO.